Thank you very much, Professor Halbers, for this kind introduction, and thank you for the invitation to Erlangen, to your consortium, Fate, Future, and Prognostication. What was it?
Freedom.
And I saw from your website and also from the lecture series that the main focus of your research center is East Asia on one side and medieval Europe on the other side. Tonight, I would like to draw your attention away from East Asia, away from Europe, to Western Asia, to the Middle East in antiquity. And I forgot I have a handout, which I can hand round now. In particular, to late Bronze Age territorial state that emerged in central Anatolia in the 17th century BC, with a center residential city at Hattusa, modern Uazköy. The language of the kings that ruled Uazköy was Hittite, the earliest attested Indo-European language. This was not the only language of the Hittite kingdom. Luwian and Pelaic are also attested, which are closely related to Hittite, and also Hattic, an isolate language, which is the language of the pre-Hittite culture in central Anatolia. We conveniently subdivide Hittite history into three periods: the Old Kingdom period, 17th to 15th century, saw a rapid expansion of the Hittite realm, power struggles among the royal dynasty, and most importantly, the development of what we could call statehood, the development of a bureaucracy, the organization of the rule over the territory of the Hittite kings, and last but not least, the development of an ideology and of the symbols of royal power. The 15th to 14th centuries are usually referred to as the Middle Hittite period. It is a period of economic and political weakness and sees the rise of competing powers to the west of the Hittite kingdom, the kingdom of Al-Zawa in western Anatolia, and towards the southeast, the Hurrian kingdom of Mitanni that rises to power in the 15th century. The heyday of the Hittite kingdom is the 14th and 13th century, which we usually refer to as the empire period. Hittite kings conquer northern Syria, rule over large parts of western Anatolia, and belong to a privileged club of great kings of the Middle East of the late Bronze Age that refer to each other as brothers and rule the world in this period. To understand Hittite culture, it is important to bear in mind that the cultural orientation of this kingdom is directed towards the southeast, with the areas towards the southeast of Anatolia. Hittite kings traded. They were in diplomatic contacts, they exchanged goods and experts, but also they, of course, competed with the other powers of that period, especially for the supremacy in the Levant and in northern Syria in this area. The other great powers of this age are the Hurrian kingdom of Mitanni in upper Mesopotamia, especially in the 15th and 14th century. In the south of Mesopotamia, Babylonia of the Kassite period. In the north of Mesopotamia, from the 14th century onwards, the emerging Middle Assyrian Empire. And of course, in the south of the map, an ancient Eastern person doesn't have Egypt on the map. Northern Africa is always cut off. But of course, Egypt of the New Kingdom period is an important player of that time in the late Bronze Age. Perhaps the most important cultural import to Hittite Anatolia from the southeast is the adoption of the Mesopotamian cuneiform script already in the 17th century by the Hittite royal administration, first for writing Akkadian, the lingua franca, the Semitic lingua franca of Mesopotamia and of the whole ancient Near East in the late Bronze Age, but already during the 16th century, cuneiform was adapted for writing the language of the Hittite kingdom, for writing Hittite, and from then onwards, the Hittite royal administration operated in Hittite, and we have thousands of texts, not only from the Hittite capital, but also from other Hittite urban centers. Hittite scribes did not only write Hittite texts, as we'll see, they continued to write Akkadian texts, even Sumerian texts, the long dead cultural language of Mesopotamia. In scholarly circles, these languages, texts in these languages were further copied and transmitted even in Hattusa by Hittite scribes. The Hittites developed their own script, the so-called Hittite hieroglyphs, attested to us on seals and monumental inscriptions from the 14th century onwards, apparently only used for the Luwian language, not for the Hittite language. And it is interesting to see that after the collapse of the Hittite Empire in the early 12th century, Hittite, the language, disappears, Hittite cuneiform disappears, but Luwian continues to be used, and Luwian hieroglyphic inscriptions are part of the scribal culture of northern Syria and southern Anatolia in the early Iron Age as well. You see here a little letter written by a woman at court to the queen, which we found last year at Boaz Cove. This is, of course, a small tablet. This is what library tablets look like, and this is an example for this, the Hittite hieroglyphs used, as far as we know, only for the Luwian language. If the Hittites had not adopted the cuneiform script, we would know nothing about divination in Hittite culture. Our only sources, but fortunately these are quite a few sources, for divination, for how to cope with future events, how to investigate the will of the gods, are all cuneiform texts. And we can subdivide the body of sources into two major groups. The first group are compendia of omens, which are written in Akkadian and are part of the traditional scholarly tradition of Mesopotamia, and were taken over with cuneiform, with other parts of Mesopotamian literature by the Hittites and transmitted in Hattusa. And these include omen collections of celestial and meteorological omens, terrestrial omens, behave straight, a black cat crosses the street and things like that. Omens indicated by anomalies of newborn lambs, lambs with 5 feet, etc. Omens obtained by oil oracle, pouring oil into water or water into oil. Omens, most importantly, omens obtained by ichthyspsy, the inspection of the internal organs of a slaughtered sheep. And for this group of omens, we not only have the large omen compendia, which basically list omens one after the other, hundreds of omens on one tablet, but also models of sheep livers, as you see here on the screen, which are inscribed with omens that refer to the area of the liver where these omens are inscribed. So this group is basically written in Akkadian, is transmitted in Akkadian, and in part translated into Hittite at Hattusa, but far is not all translated. The other large group is only in Hittite, and these are Hittite oracle reports. They come directly out of divination practice, and they are attested to us either on large library tablets or on letters which contain reports on the performance of oracles. There are other texts that give us some information on divination that are not directly linked to professional divination, so to say, like historical texts that mention omens or the performance of oracles or prayers, dream reports, etc. And maybe the most famous passage in Hittite literature that refers to divination is a passage from a prayer of King Musili II, an early empire period king, at whose time Hattusa and the Hittite kingdom suffered from a plague, and a number of prayers were composed for the king to address the plague, this issue of the plague before the gods. And the king describes in front of the gods how he investigates this matter, what might be the reason for this plague. And one of these passages is here on the screen: "Gods, whatever offense you perceive, let either a man of God come and declare it, or let the old women, the diviners, the augurs declare it, or let a man see it in a dream." And here you have a short list of divination experts in the Hittite culture. What is interesting is that this prayer actually originally goes back to a Sumerian sun god hymn, which was adopted, transformed, translated, and then became part of Hittite prayer literature. And we don't have time to look at it in detail, but you can dissect this passage and pick out the divination experts that were in the text already in Mesopotamia, so to say, hundreds of years before, and the others that were added by Hittite redactors that molded this text into a proper Hittite text. And I would like to look with you at these different professions and their technologies, so to say, that they use, and thereby hopefully gain a picture of the practice of divination in a late Bronze Age Hittite Anatolia. Our first technology takes us back to ichthyspsy, especially to the liver of the sheep. This is a form of divination that is based on the inspection of the internal organs of the slaughtered sheep, especially the inspection of the liver. This is an old Mesopotamian practice already attested in the 3rd millennium BC and was adopted in Hittite Anatolia at least from the 15th century onwards. The Hittite terminology that is used to refer to the individual parts of the liver is Hurrian, basically, is not Hittite at all, mostly. And that shows that this technology was transmitted to the Hittites via Upper Mesopotamia through the area where Hurrian was spoken, for example, the area of the kingdom of Mitanni. So this linguistic indicator shows us that this is not a direct loan from Babylonia, but a slow spread of a technology over the Middle East during the Bronze Age. It's basically a very simple method. In detail, it's very complicated. Any anomaly that you find on the liver of the sheep is an indication of something unfavorable, and depending on whether it's on an area that affects you or whether it's in an area that affects your so-called enemy, it is good for you or bad for you. Left and right play an important role here, and one goes through the different areas of the liver. Here an extract of a description from the Middle Hittite period of a liver. The Nipashuri, we don't know where that is firm on the right and on the left side. Shintachi, check. Keldi, check. Keshri, unfavorable. Onini, marked on the left side. All over, not favorable. Basically, the firm Nipashuri we know is favorable. We know that if it's just checked, Shintachi is okay, Keldi is okay, that's also favorable. Keshri is clearly unfavorable. Onini is the finger of the liver here. That has a mark on the left side. The left side affects only the enemy, so it's good for you. But this shows that one unfavorable feature makes the whole thing unfavorable for you, because it has only one unfavorable feature. And here, to give you an impression, we know roughly where these, or sometimes even precisely where these areas of the liver are. A method closely related to ichthyspsy of the sheep is the observation of the sheep's behavior before the slaughter. That gives you additional, can be interpreted, and gives the expert who is responsible for ichthyspsy additional information. The expert who was responsible for this technology, well, we translate him diviner. We don't know his Hittite name or the designation for this profession, because it's always written with Sumerian word signs that stand for diviner in Mesopotamia as well as in Hittite culture, though there was certainly a Hittite word to refer to this profession. The same profession was responsible for a second technique, the so-called Mushenchuri technology, which Mushen means bird in Sumerian. This is an oracle technology that uses a bird called Mushenchuri, and it's never described how it works, but since the diviner is responsible for it, and since the ecstasy of birds, especially of pigeons, is well known from 2nd millennium Mesopotamia and Upper Mesopotamia, it is very likely that this Khuri bird was also slaughtered and looked at, maybe the liver, maybe other organs, we don't know exactly. An example for how this works, an oracle with the Khuri bird, I take an example from the period of one of the last empire period kings, Tutkhaliya IV, whom you see here in relief. And there was an issue with a lady called Sausgati, who was dead but clearly angry. And it was investigated how and when and whether one should perform a ritual to soothe the dead Sausgati. And they had to find out why she was angry. And it's just a short extract from this long investigation, this long oracle report. If it is the curse of that same Sausgati when alive and as long as she lived, and because at that moment she had cursed, and because the deceased is angry, but furthermore, and now she's addressed direct, O deceased, you are not because of any other matter somehow angry, then let the Khuri bird be favourable. That's question and demanded outcome. Outcome is unfavourable, and that means no, wrong supposition. And then they go on ask another question, do her children utter curses and stir up the disease? Are they responsible for it? And then there's another technology, but then it says that same question with the diviner, let the Khuri bird be unfavourable, outcome unfavourable, and that means confirmed. The children are to be blamed. But you see that there's no information on what they actually did to the Khuri bird in this technology, but I assume it was dead and open. But also live birds could be used for oracles. The observation of the flight of birds is one of the important oracle technologies in ancient Anatolia. It is not attested in that form in Mesopotamia. It contained the observation of the direction of the flight of birds, their coming and going, how they perch, how they fly off, whether they call, how they interact with each other, and how they turn their beak, and things like that. The expert responsible, we translate him augur. Again, we don't know the Hittite word for this profession because it's always written with Sumerian logograms, which basically mean bird watcher, which is all right for that profession, I guess. In that form, this technology is only attested in Hittite Anatolia in the ancient Near East. An example from a bird oracle report, that same question through the augur, let the birds confirm it. The birds always either confirm or reject. And so the demand is here, let the birds confirm it. And then comes the report. We saw a Husa bird in the Tar area. It came at the front from the favorable area and flew off in the middle. We saw a Saluaya bird in the Gun area. It came upwards at the back from the favorable area and flew off at the front. Behind the road, we saw two eagles in the Gun area. They came upwards at the back from the favorable area and flew off at the front. It has been confirmed. We don't understand this very well, actually, what is going on. And one important text, but what you see is that areas play a certain role. There's apparently a field of observation. And this fragment of a cuneiform tablet is important because of the drawing here that is only fragmentarily preserved on this side. It's a tablet with bird oracles, and this is probably the drawing or sketch of an observation field for oracle birds. And it had, on the basis of the text and this sketch, the observation fields have been restored, reconstructed by, not by me, but by other Hittitologists in this manner. The auger stands here, in front of one field. Then is a road, and there's another field behind the road. In the text, you also saw that it says there was a third observation behind the road. And that is that is typical for these texts, that you have two observations in the front field, so to say, and another observation behind the road, and then you get three observations in total, and then you have a statistic of favorable and unfavorable. And the field seems to be divided in, on the one hand, a front area. You can't really see that, but this is a different, slightly different color. A back area, a favorable area on the right, an unfavorable area on the left. Unfavorable on the left, then a gun area, we don't know what gun means, it's an abbreviation which we don't understand, that is diagonally like this, and a tar area, again we don't understand what that means, it's an abbreviation that goes like this. And the, with these different areas you can describe the movements of the birds, not exactly, but according to the main directions, diagonal, straight, back, out, and that happens. How they interpreted the various movements is not clear so far. It seems to be that movement from the favorable area is usually implies confirmation by the birds, and more movement from the unfavorable areas indicates rejection of the birds. But many things about the operation of these bird flight oracles are not yet fully understood. And animals are not only used in this technology, but also in our next technology. Here, not birds are used, but a water snake in a water basin. And this basically works like this, that the snake is assigned a symbolic name, and there are symbolic locations in the water basin, and the snake's movements throughout the water basin are observed, and then are interpreted and give a certain outcome. An example is this text here. It's actually one of the few texts. This seems to be a rare technology. Those evil portents which occurred in the city of Kumachi, and the evil that happened there afterwards, further, the evil signs which are occurring now, do they concern evil affecting the person of His Majesty, so the king? If so, let the snake of the person of His Majesty be unfavorable. And then they report, we assigned the snake of the person of His Majesty to thriving. That's the starting point, a symbolic location. Clinging to the surface, it seized long years and hit at dignity. That was the first snake. Now comes the next round. Second snake. Above it seized half and hit at dignity. Third snake, it came down from the dry area to ruin and death. It hit at dignity of the fate goddesses. Result, favorable. That means these signs do not concern His Majesty. Yeah? And now they go on. Do they concern events in this year? That's also interesting, even if His Majesty is not affected by it. If so, let the snake of the person of His Majesty be unfavorable. And then it goes on, and there's again three snakes that are doing their way through the water basin. We assigned the snake of the person of His Majesty to Storm God, starting point. It moved in circles inside the basin. It hit at dignity of the deity of horses. Second snake, it came from sickness, etc. This is again favorable, so it doesn't even affect this year. The use of symbolic locations, which are indicated here with the small caps in the text, is also an important feature of another technology which was used by the so-called old woman, which you already met in the Mursili prayer. Old woman is the literal translation of the Sumerian word sign that was used to write the name of this, or the professional designation of this female practitioner. In Hittite, she's called Hasawa woman, which means she has somehow to do with birth. But how far that really defines the profession is a different matter. We know her especially as a ritual expert and as a divination expert. And she might be responsible for this, observing the behavior of the water snake, but we don't know that for certain. She's certainly responsible for the so-called kin oracle. Kin is again a Sumerian word sign. It's probably read in Hittite anyat, which means work, procedure, or something like that. Doesn't tell us very much about this oracle. Its basic procedure seems to be that there is an active symbol that does something, then it takes another passive symbol and gives it to a third beneficiary symbol, so to say, and the overall process is called the ways, the traces. But we don't know the identity of these objects because, as you'll see, the texts don't tell us. This is an oracle inquiry about what His Majesty the King should do during the winter. That's always a question because you don't campaign in the winter, so the king is out of work. This year, His Majesty proposes to winter in Hattusa. If we have nothing to fear for the person of His Majesty up in Hattusa, and you, O gods, have approved wintering in Hattusa for His Majesty, then let the kin oracle be favorable. And then comes a report on this procedure. And again, I've put the symbolic the symbols in small caps. The deity took for himself the whole soul and blood and gave them to the king on the second day. That's apparently the metaphoric expression for second procedure. The gods arose and took well-being and gave it to the assembly. On the third day, the days arose and took the year into good. Overall outcome, favorable. So the king can winter in Hattusa, yes? Because the demanded outcome was let it be favorable. It was favorable, that means yes. But they want to know for certain. We place the kin of confirmation as a counter check. They check again. Let the kin oracle be favorable. The mother goddess arose and took the kindnesses of the gods into long years on the second day, etc. Overall outcome, favorable. So again, this is confirmed, and now the king, I suppose, can really spend the winter in the capital without having to fear to be murdered or having the gods' wrath on him. This oracle type is like the water snake oracle, like the observation of the birds only known from Anatolian sources. These, the ecstispicy, the observation of the sheep before slaughter, the huri bird, the observation of the bird's flight, the snake oracle and the kin oracle are the main technologies that are attested to us in the Hittite oracle reports that were practiced. But there are, of course, also other forms of divination which we just do not know very much about. There was certainly prophecy and ecstatic speech. There was a man of God. We don't know very much about him or what he did. There's a hieroglyphic Luwian inscription from the early Iron Age from Tel Achmai in northern Syria, where a person in this royal inscription gives an oracle to someone, and the logogram in hieroglyphic Luwian for this man, who must be something like a prophet, maybe like the Hittites Uniant, looks like this. Here you have it big. So I have the suspicion that the Hittite prophets were had funny hats on their heads, but I can't prove it. There was the use of dreams, of incubation. Lots are sometimes used, especially to determine who sits where during a ritual, for example. There seems to be a smoke oracle and a kind of cup oracle. And then there are, of course, unsolicited omens that play a role, like dreams that you do not solicit, or natural phenomena, eclipses, terrible storms, things like that, that are interpreted as portents, as evil signs, and then can be investigated via oracles. And the investigation, as you have seen, I hope, from these little extracts from long, long tablets, long, long texts, can be very protracted and involve the investigation, other questions, further questioning, involve counter checks, are not just very simple questions that are asked once and then it is just favorable or unfavorable, and that's the end of it. And I can't go with you through such a long text in detail because it would take us a long time, though they are actually interesting in their logic, how they work, and also with regard to the social history, especially of the Hittite royal court. But here, I hope you can see that it's a bit small. You have an overview of the beginning of such an oracle report about an investigation in the reign, again, of Tutralia the fourth, the man you saw in the relief, he's ill. The king is ill, and that, of course, is a problem. Kings must not be ill, and it has to be investigated why the king is ill. And probably it is because some deity is angry. So the first question of this oracle inquiry is, it's rephrased here, the questions are more involved usually. Is the king's illness due to the wrath of the deity of Arusna? Then there's a demanded result that is the technology is ecstispicy and says, first ecstispicy, let it be favorable. Second ecstispicy, let it be unfavorable. Then two ecstispicies are performed. First is favorable, second is unfavorable, and that confirms that the deity of Arusna's anger is responsible for the king's illness. But that doesn't help yet. So we have to have more specific information. And the question two is then, has the deity's wrath been triggered by events in the temple? Demanded result by ecstispicy, let the liver be unfavorable. Result, unfavorable. Okay, an event in the temple is to blame. Question three, we want to know even more. Has the deity's wrath been triggered exclusively by events in the temple? And is it not directed directly against the king? Demanded result, favorable. Investigative result, unfavorable. Oh, we are in trouble. The king is really affected by this. So we have to ask further questions, clearly. Question four. Is the deity's wrath against the king due to the curses of the queen mother against Amatala before the deity because of Amatala's cultic offenses? Clearly something that was a trouble at court at the time. We don't know very much about this affair otherwise. Demanded result, unfavorable, and the liver is indeed unfavorable, so yes, it has to do with the queen mother. We think, but we're not certain, we want to know for sure, so we do a counter-check by Huribert Oracle and say, let it be favorable, but it is unfavorable, and that kills our first investigation. Ah, it doesn't seem to be quite right. We're in the right direction, but the counter-check was negative, so we have to go on. Question five. Is the deity's wrath against the king due to the fact that the queen mother did not fulfill a vow to the deity of Arusna? Demanded result, unfavorable. The liver is unfavorable, so that's confirmed. We know that this unfulfilled vow is to blame. Now we want to know, is that all? That's very important. We don't want to leave something out. Question six. Is this the only reason for the deity's wrath against the king? Then let the liver be favorable. Unfavorable. Ha! There must be other reasons, so we have to go on with this inquiry. Question seven. Is another reason for the deity's wrath against the king the fact that the bride of the king brought Amatala to court in secret? Then let the liver be unfavorable. Unfavorable. Aha. There's another whole can of worms that has to be opened, and the text continues and continues and continues with counter checks. This, of course, is very involved. The health of the king is concerned, so this is a high state matter. This is not just something. But counter checks are also used for smaller matters, it seems. This is a letter that was found in a Hittite provincial town called Sarissa, not far from modern Sivas in eastern Anatolia, and it is a report about, well, a member of the urban elite and evil portents concerning him. Say to the Lord, the chief of the palace officials, my Lord. Thus speaks the mayor. That's the mayor of the provincial town writing to the chief of the palace officials in the capital, who's one of the highest officials of the realm. And he reports, Ia, the old woman, so one of our divination experts, spoke the following to me. The oracular trace, that's this way trace, turned out bad for the person of the son of the priestess, apparently a high-ranking priestess in Sarissa. And these traces occurred. Bad, that's a kin oracle now that is quoted, bad was taken and moved back to Chalmasuid. I performed the oracular consultation four times, and all four times it turned out bad. So let them perform a consultation there as well. And now they report on the further consultation. So we proceeded to seek an answer to the following question further by observing birds. Concerning this which Ea has said, should we fear for the person of the son of the priestess? It is confirmed. And then in the letter follow the reports as we had it before from the observation of the birds, which hopefully, though this is actually weird because it's counterintuitive in a way, the favorable and unfavorable outcomes, but apparently it confirms that the son of the priestess is really in trouble. So the structure is there was a kin oracle indicating harm for this person, and then another technology was employed to confirm whether this is really something to worry about or whether the symbols of the old woman just went wrong. And what is interesting about this text is that it was found in Kushakle, which you see here. This is the site. And in Kushakle, Sarissa, a sacred area outside the city was archaeologically, and by the evidence of the texts, identified in this area right before this escarpment here where the rocks come down. And there's a sacred pool there, and the archaeologists who worked there observed that in this area the birds are very, there are apparently thermal winds there in front of the rock face, and there are many birds. So we maybe can imagine where the birds, the observation fields were placed, and this oracle was performed. Now, why did they use these oracle techniques? What are the main topics? It is, of course, a technology to communicate with the divine sphere, and a Hittite goddess and a god. These are tiny pendants, no higher than 4 centimeters, so don't be deceived by the slide. Of course, one wanted to communicate with the gods, and the main purpose was to have a systematic, controlled investigation of what the gods actually want, and in particular, why the gods are angry. And this anger of the gods is apparent to humans either in evil portents, whose significance has to be investigated, or actually in disasters that already happened, like illness of the king, etc. And you have to investigate why this actually happened. And you want to find out what is the reason, and we humans think in causal patterns, and that of course then allows the Hittites to react appropriately and effectively against the threatening evil. The areas that are topics in these oracle reports are, of course, often the administration of the state cult. It is often military strategy, but it is basically everything that concerns the king and the royal family and their welfare. And there are, as you've seen, there are squabbles at court, conflicts between high-ranking members of the royal family can be investigated as possible reasons of certain events. But it puts the Hittites in control, they hoped, I think. These texts have not been well edited, all these oracle reports, but some of them have been studied in detail, and there are a number of comprehensive studies, and therefore that's why you have the handout, because there's a little bibliography on there if you want to read further on this topic, which is not exhaustive. You can go to the Hittitologie Portal Mainz, there you'll find a complete systematic bibliography of Hittitology, and you type in prophecy and divination and you find everything. So is there anything new? So far I've basically reported what any Hittitologist could tell you. I wanted to show you one example how even insignificant small finds can still add some detail, admittedly information, on how these technologies worked, how they functioned. This is this thing which you saw in the starting slide, which the archaeologists, when they found it in 2013, immediately dubbed the Matterhorn. they hoped it was a three-dimensional map of the Hittite realm, and hoped that this might be a mountain with a river in the foothills. It's of course not. It's a fragment. It's basically a clay tetrahedron. It's massive. It has cuneiform inscriptions on all sides of this, all three sides of the tetrahedron, also on the flat surface that surrounds it. It was found out of context, and it has this deep incision, but it has nothing to do with a map or a geographical model, but it is the fragment of a liver model. It is what we call the chorded lobe, or the processus pyramidalis of the liver. That is a lobe here that, if you, when you open the sheep and you can lift up this lobe, then it sticks up or stands up like a little pyramid if you hold it up. And the Babylonians called this the finger, and the Hittites called it the finger in Hurrian, so to say. What is special about this find is not that it's the fragment of a liver model. We have many liver models from Hattusa. We have a number of complete liver models. This is only a small fragment. What is interesting about it is its size. It's 5 centimeters high, which is very high for the finger of a liver model. It means that the overall model was about 30 centimeters wide. So a model like this, normally they are only about a third or half of the size. And what we have here for the first time, and I would love to have the whole model, but I don't have it, and there's not much hope to get the rest. What we have here for the first time is that the finger, the corded lobe, here you have a reconstruction of how the whole model, what it would look like and where the finger is located. It is the only model from the ancient East that we have where the finger bears inscriptions. There are other models where that have inscriptions that refer to the finger, but this is the only model that has inscriptions on the sides of the finger, and it gave us for the first time information on what they actually called the sides of the fingers in detail, and especially how the finger was oriented, where is left and right. That's almost the most important thing if you want to perform ictyspsy. I won't go through this in detail, but it's a nice example how ictyspsy works. You have one side here that is red in this little extract from the drawing with one inscription on it, inscription A, and it says, if on the width of the right side of the finger there is a mark, Nergal will devour in my land. Nergal is the god of plague, the god of war, and it basically means if there is a mark on the right side, unfavorable for the client, in a poetic phrase, a metaphorical phrase. And that is, of course, what we expect. If there's a mark on the right side, it's bad for me. The eye of the oracle inquiry. And it tells us now where the right side is. And what is interesting is that the right side, what we always had assumed, that right is here and left is here, because this is the general perspective of the diviner. He looks at the liver from the dorsal edge. And this is the left part of the liver, and this is the right part of the liver. But apparently, the finger had its own internal orientation. You lifted it, and then you looked at it from this side. And left and right side together, we now know for certain, were called the width. And that is, again, not due to chance, because as you see here in this liver, these two sides, right and left, are not as clearly separate from the side compared to the third side, which is clearly different because the kidney presses in it in the sheep. So we know that this was called the wide side together, and it had a right and left side. And on the left side, there are two inscriptions. One that says, if on the width of the left side of the finger there is a mark, Nergal will devour in the land of the enemy, as we would expect. There's a mark, it's unfavorable, but it's on the left side, so it's unfavorable for the other person, for the enemy. So it's good for me, actually. And then this is this inscription here. And then there's an inscription along the ridge, which says, gives only the apodosis of the omen, and says, Nergal will devour, or if ditto, there will be a defeat. And it's interesting that this inscription says negative, but it doesn't specify whether it's for me or the enemy. And that is, of course, because it's on the ridge. You can't tell. It's in the middle. you have a problem you have to investigate further. Then there's the third side, which we now know is the middle side. Clearly, we have the right, left, and middle side. And there is an inscription running down here, inscription D, that refers to the tip of the finger, and this confirms that the tip of the finger is affecting me. That is something we knew before, but here it is, so to say, on clay. If at the tip of the finger there's a mark, Nergal was set to work in my land. Bad for me. And there's another inscription here that apparently refers to the middle side, and it says, Nergal will devour in a palace. Again, it's not specified, is it my palace or the enemy's palace? It's uncertain. And again, we are in a middle area that is not, where it's not entirely clear to whom this refers. And that is it's not new in the sense that this revolutionizes how these livers were read, but it's here clearly for the first case for the finger, so to say, on black and white. And we can just read it, and there have been long, long discussions in archaeology, which is the left side of the finger and the right side of the finger. And that is one of the nice and at the same time frustrating bits of archaeology, that there are long papers on problems and involved arguments, very intelligent arguments, and comes out a bit of clay and it just says it. And there you go. Now, so this was interesting in that regard. Another point of interest for this liver model, and that brings me, or this fragment of a liver model, that brings me back to the beginning. It is inscribed, of course, in Akkadian, as almost all liver models. It's part, so to say, of the compendia corpus, this group of liver models from Boaz Coe. And it confirms, again, it's not inscribed in the type of cuneiform that Hittite professional scribes used, but in a different type of cuneiform. And that is typical for these liver models. They are part of an imported technology, and they were written by specialists, very possibly at Hattusa, who had their training not in a Hittite school, in quotation marks, were not part of the normal, so to say, Hittite administrators' scribal training. And there are a few further orthographic features on this liver model which are rare and which are attested once, or there are parallels at Hattusa, but they also have parallels in a corpus of Akkadian omen texts from northern Syria, from the Hurrian area, where we find the same orthographies, and they give us an indication or further confirm what I said at the beginning, that this is a technology that comes from Mesopotamia and is closely connected to the area immediately to the southeast of the Hittite Empire in Upper Mesopotamia. That is where in the second millennium there are a lot of Hurrian speakers, where the kingdom of Mitanni is in the 15th and 14th century. So this is another confirmation that this of the way in which this technology spread. And thank you.